listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Ed McGrogan here at the Tennis.com podcast, back with Steve Tigner on a Wednesday. We want to catch up on a few tour things, of course, but I wanted to start with Vic Braden, who just recently passed away, and Steve and I wanted to, in particular, I want Steve's input on Vic, essentially because, you know, one little pet peeve of mine, I think, when a big sports personality or a celebrity passes that is generally an older name, is I think a lot of hosts and pundits really act like, you know, they really knew the person very well. And to be honest, I don't know a lot about Vic Braden, and that's kind of why I really want your thoughts on the man and, you know, really what his story was and what he did for the sport. So
It's really a sad note in that Vic Braden, he's sort of a big figure from the tennis boom in the United States. When you think of sort of non-players, you think of Vic Braden and Bud Collins, people who were sort of gave the texture of tennis, maybe you might say, in the 70s. He was more known as a low-level pro. He lived in Kalamazoo, which a lot of people call Tennis Town, which has the big junior tournament, so he had a tennis background there. But he was more famous as a teacher, a coach, and sort of I guess the New York Times called him a Pied Piper of tennis. He was, you know, somebody who was just really enthusiastic and got people involved in tennis at a time when the sport was really at its most popular here. I think it's also an interesting time to think about him, in that now there's a lot of talk in the U.S. about getting people, how to get people more interested in tennis, and how to coach players and also teach coaches, you know, how to coach players. That's something that the U.S. has struggled with, and I think
this is something you and I have specifically talked to Tim Mayotte about. Yeah. That was one of his things there.
And even Patrick McEnroe, when he left the USTA, that's the one thing he said that the U.S. should do better is coaching education, teaching coaches how to coach. Vic Braden, that was really what he did. He was a guy who went around the country, got people wanting to play, taught people how to teach people how to play tennis. He was really a part of the culture of tennis. If you grew up in the 70s, you saw him on TV. Some of his articles for Tennis Magazine were some of the biggest selling articles for this magazine. He was always sort of theorizing, thinking of new things, new ways to look at tennis mentally, physically.
Was there any specific philosophies that you recall of him, or is this...
I mean, one that he was big on and one that became well known was his idea of different tennis personalities. He used the Myers-Briggs psychological test, which talks about our different personality types from a psychiatry point of view. He brought that to tennis. It was pretty controversial as to whether some people didn't really believe it, but it was really something that people talked about. What's your tennis personality like? So he sort of bridged the gap between the professional game and the game you see on TV and the rec game. You know, it's hard to think of somebody who really fits that now, who people is a recognizable figure who is so enthusiastic about the sport.
Somebody who bridges those two gaps, I think now it almost makes sense that he was of that particular era and a time where not only the game was at a boom, but I think, you know, we're talking about someone like Braden who was not known for his professional playing credentials, but so many players of that boom era were not only players, but you had promoters, coaches, broadcasters, and I think back to some of the books I read about how critical all of these different tennis names really made the sport seem like the biggest thing around for really, you know, a little stretch there. You obviously had some of the greatest players the game has known, but we're looking back and seeing a lot of these men now at their older years having made such a big impact back then.
Yeah, Jack Kramer, Vic Braden started the Jack Kramer Club with Kramer in L.A., and Kramer said that of all the people he'd worked with in tennis in the 70s, that Braden was the most important for getting people involved in tennis. He said Connors, McEnroe, Borg, Chrissy, Martina. They were great as pros, but nobody really had the overall effect of Vic Braden in popularizing tennis. And I think that, you know, in whenever I went to various places in tennis, people would talk about Vic Braden. I think he was sort of somebody people could relate to from the top of the sport, you know, down to rec players. Everybody mentioned that they liked him, asked about him, wondering how he was doing. I only really met him over the last few years when he would go to Indian Wells each year. And even then, later in his life, he was always involved, always talking about theories of tennis, always still enthusiastic about the game.
Good to know. Now, this is, like I said, things I'm learning really, you know, especially this week as we hear a little more about him. So appreciate that. Moving on to the game today, and we are, you know, already have a result this morning. You know, Rafa going down in Shanghai. There's a lot more to that story. Rafa actually, his latest, you know, health issue, he's at almost every one, it seems like, but it's appendicitis. And coming from someone who had his appendix taken out many years ago, it's not pleasant. I was pretty shocked to hear that he would even be wanting to play this tournament. This isn't like a Davis Cup tie or something in like Barcelona. This is what you would think of as one of the last events that Nadal would like. He would rather die than miss this. And so I think somewhat expectedly goes down. You know, he loses to Lopez, even though Nadal had a 5-2 lead in the second set there. You know, a week ago on this podcast, we were talking about the Rafa comeback. This is obviously going to put that well back there. You know, I also wonder about this time, and you made a good point about Nadal and how, you know, this is we're seeing more and more of this with him, and we're seeing really a lot bubbling up on the ATP this whole year, that the evidence just seems to kind of mount that I think we're going to end up looking back at this year for many reasons as kind of the tipping point of where this era of Roger, Novak, Rafa completely and utterly owning every event kind of changes over. And I think it's still, you know, there's still a gradual change, and that's not to say that they aren't going to have the biggest trophies at the end of the day, but I think this is just the latest shred of evidence that 2014 is kind of a turning point, I think, in the tour.
Yeah, I think, you know, this loss, if there's ever a match you can put an asterisk on, it's Rafa's loss to Lopez with appendicitis. It's hard to know why he played. It's not Davis Cup. It's not a slam. It's not even a match that he needed to play to collect an appearance fee. He wasn't going to get one in Shanghai anyway. I think he missed a few months in August and September, and he just didn't want to keep missing things for physical reasons. I think that's probably depressing to him. We'll see what happens, whether he has his appendix out, and then he would probably be out for the rest of the year anyway. But you're right. It does go with a trend of Rafa losing to players he hasn't lost to in the past. That's something we saw with Federer at the same age when he was 28. I do think this will be the year when you have Wawrinka winning a slam and Cilic winning a slam that you'll look back as a starting to open up the game a little bit. But for me right now, it really opens up the future, the near future for Novak Djokovic. He still seems to be on a roll in China. We'll see how he does in Shanghai. He's won the last 2 years there. He doesn't seem to lose in Asia. But even beyond that, through the rest of the year, you know, he's looking like he's going to finish number one again. And if Rafa is out for the rest of the year or is slowed down by this, you know, that's one less challenger for Novak. He did have a bad stretch this summer, but I don't think we can say he's declining at the moment.
No, yeah, not at all. And I think to back that up a little bit is you look at the players that have made strides this year. Wawrinka still kind of as inconsistent as ever, especially lately. It's not as if there have been surges, but there hasn't been that sustained challenger to Djokovic. And I think for the most part, we've seen this year that a lot of the losses, I think you would generally pin them on what Djokovic was unable to do. I think it's still at this point, it's kind of, if Djokovic plays his best, it's really hard to see anyone kind of competing with him. And I think that's going to make the remainder of this year, I think, a little more kind of interesting to see how he ends up playing this, because especially as you said about how he's traditionally taken and ran with the end of the years, and it's no coincidence that his almost more than half his slam titles came in Australian Open. So to follow what he has been able to do his whole career there. So I think you're very right that Djokovic still, I think, holds the keys to everything. And I think it goes back to really saying how important that win at Wimbledon was to him. I think that was just, it was crucial at the time. And I think as time has passed and we saw what happened to the U.S. Open, I think it's even more, telling.
And also, I think it's a question of who is going to come up and be the next consistent players. We saw this week already, Wawrinka is out, Dimitrov's out, Raonic is out with the flu, Cilic is out already. Not that that's indicative of the long term, but nobody outside of the big four has shown, all right, here's the guy who's going to come in next. Mm-hmm. Guys are still, they're still not as consistent.
No, we were just looking at the Del Potro cover of Tennis Magazine
maybe
20 minutes ago, and there's, we had many talks about this the year before, so there's more work to be done from all of them, really. So we'll see where that takes us. Let's end a little. We have the WTA Finals. It's now been renamed WTA Finals. You're going to see that nomenclature going forward. To these year-end tournaments tend to change names more frequently than the other ones. So that we're now at the WTA Finals. That'll take place in Singapore the week after next. So I think we'll get a little more into the field next week. But one who we wanted to mention in between this podcast and the last one that we didn't give a lot of time to last week was Maria Sharapova, and lo and behold, she goes and wins Beijing last week, the last significant tournament before the season-ending championships. Beats Kvitova, who has really sustained things pretty nicely on the whole since Wimbledon, you can say. But Sharapova, I think, in a sense, sort of reminding that she still, on the right day, is pretty darn hard to beat, and will probably be heard from in Singapore in all likelihood. We don't even know what Serena's status for that will be. That she's kind of a wild card for there, so we have to give credit to Sharapova for sure about that.
Yeah, I think this win really rounds out her year and shows that she had a really good year. You don't sort of think she was inconsistent, but she started the year, she was injured at the end of last year with her shoulder. She has a new coach at the beginning of this year. She just started a little slowly. She was really good on clay, and now she's won this big hardcourt tournament where everybody was in it. So she's won four tournaments. She's now number two. You have to really say hasn't gotten a lot of publicity, but that's quite a comeback year for her. She also sounds pretty eager for Singapore, which is, I don't think all the other players will be at this point, will be feeling that way. I know Kvitova has already said that she felt a little tired. But Sharapova, the one issue is she's number two now. Where does she go from there? A lot of the other players, I feel like it used to be the number one ranking in the WTA was almost like a curse, because you really didn't, when Jelena Jankovic had it, Safina, Wozniacki, they were never able to really capitalize on that and win Grand Slams. It was always Serena who was there. Now it almost feels like with Serena number one, the number two ranking seems to have the curse. Azarenka gets to number two, she gets hurt. Lina gets to number two, now she's retired, she got hurt.
Halep
gets to two, sort of struggles. Now Sharapova's to what? What's next? Obviously, Maria's had her struggles with Serena.
In a sense, it's all It's almost one and the same, the one and two, because I think how Serena has treated her schedule in those times, those years when you had the Wozniacki, Yankovic, Safina number one, Serena at that point still was not giving credence and particular importance to the the non-slam events. Mm-hmm. And over the years, she's become more and more consistent, more, it seems, invested in those. Like
she plays more.
She plays more, and she, when she wins a, I don't know if it's a thing to do with age or everything that she's recently gone through, but, she's giving, I think, celebrations and really joy in winning just matches, really, not even titles, no matter what event she's playing. And I think that's going to be, one of these things that when whoever writes a Serena autobiography way down the road, it's going to be, I think, a particularly interesting set of chapters as to this late career run. But it's not even as if she went away and came back, but it's just that she's kind of flipped the script in a way. And I think that's what we're talking about here, about everything in relation to that is this number two little oddity here that
yeah,
Sharapova
holds.
We'll
see how Maria. I mean, I feel like Azarenka, she got hurt and it was bad luck, but I also feel like she ran into that Serena, hit her ceiling in a way at number two, and we'll see what Maria can do, and we'll see how Serena's health is, going forward.
Yeah, we'll see right away, like I said, in Singapore, if she decides to play that or not. And we'll talk about that a lot next week on the podcast. Here with Steve Tigner, I'm Ed McGrogan. Thank you for listening. Once again, Tennis.com Podcast.
You've been enjoying the Tennis.com Podcast. For all the latest news and events, head over to Tennis.com.